it's a ruse. It's not just a person in Pyongyang reporting about all the things they love about the country.
North Korea flashes modern world upgrades. It's Friday, August 7th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia, also Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Coming up, consultants for international politicians. U.S. schools get a high-level order. COVID behind bars. Aussie wildlife drones. And an artistic young immigrant. It's all on today's VOA Asia. On yesterday's program, we had a rare inside glimpse into North Korea that made us wonder what VOA correspondent Bill Gallo is seeing as he reports from Seoul. It turns out North Korean state media have been getting a makeover. From high-definition TV broadcasts to shiny new on-screen graphics to laid-back video blogs. But the cosmetic changes will not be able to alter North Korea's perception as one of the world's most censored and isolated countries.
When you think of North Korean state TV, this is what may come to mind. A traditionally dressed news anchor, melodramatically singing the praises of the dear leader. These days, North Korean state media also sounds like this.
Good day to you, my friends. I was wondering how you're doing these days.
Meet Eun-ah, who calls herself an ordinary North Korean girl. For about the last 6 months, she's appeared in these laid-back, blog-style videos, speaking in English as she tours Pyongyang.
Good afternoon. This is Eun-ah from Pyongyang. Today, I come up with three new updates about DPRK.
The videos have received over 1.6 million views on YouTube. They're also posted to a Twitter account called Cold Noodle Fan, which has links to North Korea's government, says Colin Swirko of the Seoul-based NK News.
It's a ruse. It's not just a person in Pyongyang reporting about all the things they love about the country.
Zwirko and NK News have followed the Cold Noodle Fan account for years. And he says its persona has changed dramatically.
Late 2017 or early 2018, they wrote that they were a poor person living in Japan. And then later they became a Russian named Yulia.
The Eun-ah videos are designed for a foreign audience, apparently with the goal of improving North Korea's image internationally. But the country's domestic broadcasts have also been upgraded. In recent years, North Korean state TV has gone high definition. Its announcers are younger, studios more modern, and its news stories make use of techniques seen in foreign broadcasts, including B-roll and establishing shots. It's even experimented with complex 3D infographics. The changes appear to be an acknowledgement that North Korean media faces competition from much more advanced content produced in South Korea and elsewhere. A lot of that content is smuggled across the border. Martin Williams, who follows North Korean state media.
If you watch a South Korean TV drama, the production quality is a lot higher than a lot of North Korean state TV fare. So, the audience is beginning to expect some of that.
But while the broadcasts are visually more appealing, Williams says it's far from clear whether they'll be more effective, in part because the changes are only cosmetic.
What hasn't changed is the content. It is still the same old boring stuff. It is reports on things that Kim Jong-un has done. When Kim Jong-un hasn't done anything, they go back to places that he visited 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 years ago.
Even Eun-ah's blog-style videos can be heavy-handed.
Hi, hello, good morning.
In this video, Eun-ah is going for a job. It's a chance to show off parts of the city, which is much wealthier than other parts of the country. But as the camera pans, large segments of the neighborhood are blurred out. A seemingly random instance of state censorship that Eun-ah never even explains. It's a reminder that even though North Korea may be trying to improve its image, meaningful changes appear nowhere on the horizon. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
These are among some of the top Asia headlines that you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. U.S. allies tighten alliance to contain China's maritime expansion. Heavy rain in South Korea brings flooding and landslides. 10 million Afghans likely to be infected and recovered from COVID-19, according to a survey. Kim directs aid to North Korean town under virus lockdown. Tokyo governor urges residents to refrain from summer holiday travel. You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories and much more at Facebook at VOA Asia. We also invite you to stop by our voanews.com website. We continue with VOA Asia. From getting a U.S. president elected to helping politicians run for office, campaign political strategists can often impact the outcome of a race. When not working on a U.S. campaign, some strategists advise candidates in other countries, while others work mostly on foreign campaigns. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has details on the business of international consulting and why U.S. political consultants are sought after in countries abroad.
From in-person rallies to grassroots outreach to ads, political campaigning in the U.S. is in a league of its own.
A lot of people view U.S. elections as sort of this Super Bowl of elections or the World Cup of elections because we do just have so much money pouring in.
The amount of money in a political campaign and frequency of U.S. elections at all levels of government have turned campaign strategizing into a full-time profession. Former strategist Bob Schrum has worked on campaigns in the U.S. and abroad.
We're in a permanent campaign so that people are really professionally committed and involved in and thinking about this all the time.
He says foreign politicians look for experienced strategists to tap into campaign savvy found in America. The business of international political consulting took off in the early 90s after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union, says political consultant Reva Levinson.
That's what permitted the U.S. political consulting business to be realized in places like Latin America, you know, former Soviet Union, Africa, because we started, people started becoming democratic in our model.
Schrum, who advised U.S. politicians and consulted in a host of other countries, including Britain, Israel, and Colombia, says messaging is critical in any campaign, regardless of cultural differences.
When we first were involved in Colombia, the style of advertising that prevailed was basically for the candidate for 30 seconds to stand there in front of a giant crowd, and the crowd would cheer. And we said, you know, we really need to make some spots where you just talk to people one-on-one about what you're going to do.
Levinson has been consulting in various African countries for more than three decades, including Liberia, where she advised Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who became the first democratically elected female president in Africa in 2005. Now, many countries are more experienced with campaigns, and so international strategists need to stay on top of their field.
You're not putting a campaign 101 in front of people. You've got to come to the table with something specifically value added that they don't have.
Levinson says that means working on the integrity of the election process where corruption and intimidation may exist. With widespread use of the internet and social media, digital advisors like Jory Craig have also come on board.
In some countries in Asia, you have 100% of the population on social media now. When you look at the data and it's showing you trends like that, you have to adjust your strategy accordingly.
Craig has worked as a digital consultant in Southeast Asia, Africa, Latin America, and Eastern Europe. She not only translates online data into useful information for campaigns, she also helps weed through disinformation tactics.
I would say the number one thing I help campaigns with is understanding what type of online attack is significant and what is something they can ignore.
Craig says there's a trend of homegrown political consultants emerging in many countries around the world as the business of political consulting matures and U.S. experts are no longer the only game in town. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
Happening now in Asia, a small group of aging survivors, families, and a few dignitaries gathered Thursday in Hiroshima, Japan, to observe the 75th anniversary of the world's first atomic bombing. The attack killed 140,000 people and reduced the entire city to ruins. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us today on VOA Asia. The Trump administration is insisting that students return to the classroom for the new school year, which begins in just weeks. But school districts across the United States are wrestling with how to do that safely. VOA's Steve Barragona reports.
In Los Angeles, California, Catholic schools are preparing to welcome students back this fall. Luis Hayes is principal of St. Joseph's School.
Right now, the plan is to return back to in-school instruction, but with mitigation. Desks will be 6 feet apart. We'll have partitions, masks, temperature screenings.
President Donald Trump threatened to cut funding to U.S. schools that do not open. But with coronavirus infections rising in L.A. County, Superintendent Austin Buettner says public schools will be online only.
Well, the new school year will begin in August. It will not start with students at school facilities. The health and safety of all in the school community is not something we can compromise.
It's a tough decision. Health and education experts say kids are better off at school. At-home learning is not working as well for many students. Both classwork and social skills are suffering. And many kids are missing out on more than education, notes U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Chief Robert Redfield.
Whether it's the absence of mental health services for the 7.1 million kids who get their mental health services in school, whether it's the nutritional services that some of the kids get, whether it's the fact that this is where most of our mandatory reporting for sexual abuse and child abuse is.
Have a good day.
Children's risk of infection, severe illness, and death from COVID-19 are much lower than adults, but not zero. And teachers and staff are at risk. Teachers want to go back to school, but not if it's unsafe, says National Education Association President Lily Eskelson Garcia.
And I want Donald Trump to sit in the back of my class of 39 and breathe their air. I want him to sit there for 7 hours, 5 days a week, and have those kids cough and sneeze on him.
Schools in Germany, South Korea, and many other countries have reopened with new measures to prevent infections. Barriers, masks, and temperature checks. More space between students. More cleaning and hand hygiene. Schools have not become virus hotspots in these countries, but they had the epidemic under control before they opened, unlike much of the United States, says Jennifer Nuzzo at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security.
In communities where the case numbers are rapidly increasing, it may not be possible to safely reopen schools until disease transmission is lowered. Can't stress that enough.
And the start of the school year is just weeks away, leaving little time to contain the outbreak and prepare classrooms. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. Indonesia's COVID-19 task force recorded at least 90 new coronavirus clusters in Jakarta office buildings July 28th, with 459 confirmed workplace cases. That's a tenfold increase since large-scale social restrictions concluded in early May. Jakarta's governor has vowed to improve enforcement oversight and expand testing. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, the coronavirus pandemic is making its way into prisons nationwide. That's especially true at San Quentin State Prison in California, where more than 50% of the 3,500 inmates have tested positive for COVID-19, the disease caused by the virus. But there are efforts to release some prisoners early and enact other measures to try to keep inmates safe. Dina Mitchell tells us more.
Demonstrators chained themselves to the gate in front of California Governor Gavin Newsom's Sacramento home, calling for mass release of prison inmates statewide due to COVID-19 outbreaks in the state's prisons. For Chanda Williams, the fight is personal. She's been teaching yoga to inmates at San Quentin State Prison for the past 6 years. The prison has the worst coronavirus outbreak in the state's prison system, which houses more than 100,000 inmates. Williams has written letters urging authorities to release prisoners.
These people were sentenced for crimes. They were not sentenced to die in prison, and certainly not by the negligence of the state. The state has a responsibility to maintain their health and their safety and their well-being, and the state has failed in that. The CDCR has failed in that.
Like other institutions caught off guard by the virus, prisons in the U.S. have struggled with how to keep people, inmates and staff, safe. California is conducting widespread testing, and the governor has given early releases to about 3,500 inmates to ease overcrowding. But there have been setbacks, like in May, when it's believed prisoners transferred from the California Institution for Men in Chino to San Quentin brought the virus with them. In July, a top prison official addressed inmates in a video.
We are making unprecedented changes to our operations, and we recognize the burden this has placed on those incarcerated in our prisons.
At San Quentin, at least 19 inmates have died of coronavirus, including 10 on death row. Nationwide, more than 70,000 prisoners have tested positive, and at least 100 have died, according to the Federal Bureau of Prisons. One of Williams' students, 41-year-old Chan Thun Bun, tested positive July 1st, the day he was released. Bun was not given early release, but earned parole, he says, after serving 23 years of a 50-year sentence. He called the prison's handling of COVID-19 cases a chaotic experience.
Because they had this thing where they like, you guys got to space out. And we told them, we can't space out in our cell. Our cell is 5 by 9 by 14. And then they came out with a memo, you guys got to sleep head to toe. And we're like, what does that do?
The prison did not respond to a request for comment. In a video to the prison community, officials proposed steps to increase physical distancing, like moving inmates to alternative housing or other prisons, and changing schedules to allow for more sanitation. The inmates released so far were within 180 days of completing their sentences. The state is planning to release several thousand more, but says it must be done carefully.
You don't want to just send people out into park benches, into homeless shelters. We've got to make sure that we responsibly move people out, but with a deep sense of urgency.
Releases on a much bigger scale than what we're seeing need to happen if we're going to keep people safe.
While officials say they are working to release more inmates as a way to limit those exposed to coronavirus, advocates continue to protest, saying it's not happening fast enough. For VOA News, Dina Mitchell, Oakland, California.
Coronavirus questions. Can the virus be spread by mosquito bites? Is there a vaccine or medication that prevents it? Is there any medicine that cures it? The answer to all of the questions is no. The best steps to take: wash your hands, cover your cough, stay at home if you are sick or advised to by local authorities.
Now on VOA Asia, conservationists in Australia are hoping infrared drones might help save the remaining koala population in New South Wales, one of the regions most affected by recent Australian bushfires. The infrared camera makes it easier to spot the iconic marsupials, not bears, which scientists say could be extinct by 2050. VOA's Mariama Diallo has this report.
Douglas Thrawn, a cinematographer from California, is using drones equipped with infrared cameras to help track koalas in the wild in the Australian state of New South Wales.
You fly the drone over an area, and you do it while the ground is cooler, and then the heat of the animal pops up. And you can see the shape of the koala, basically.
Thrawn had previously used his device to locate and rescue animals after Hurricane Dorian struck the Bahamas. While there, he learned of devastating bushfires in Australia.
I saw these videos of basically, you know, koalas being burned up and people trying to rescue koalas.
The Australian bushfires in 2019 and 2020 killed or displaced nearly 3 billion animals, including koalas, kangaroos, and other native species, according to a study released last week by the Worldwide Fund for Nature. WWF called it one of the worst wildfire disasters in modern history. Now with the ability to track koalas using drones, Stuart Blanche of WWF marvels at what he calls a breakthrough.
Drones are sort of a next level way of quickly finding koalas across hectares of bush.
Volunteers also are tracking koalas. Sue Gay and her daughter regularly look for animals around their home in a town near Sydney. One method is to look for fresh koala feces.
Others tend to look up into the trees for them. I tend to look down, and I can tell more by that. So that's how I find them.
And then you've got the scratch marks on the trees as well.
While tracking koalas this way is slow, they say the effort to save them is worth it.
It's reality that in 30 years we may not have koalas, and our future generations need to be able to have that. So if anything, it was a kick in the bum. Let's get into action and save these guys.
The New South Wales Threatened Species Advisory Board, an independent committee of scientists, has started a review to determine whether the koala's status should be upgraded to endangered. The World Wildlife Fund warns that without urgent government intervention, koalas in eastern Australia could be extinct by 2050. Mariama Jalou, VOA News.
Artist Dominic Kokoza is only 18 years old, but his painting of two migrant children holding a sign that reads, "Bring our mom back," is already being displayed at the U.S. Capitol. Another of his work is hanging in the Smithsonian Hirshhorn Museum. Adopted from Guatemala, Dominic focuses his work around the U.S. immigration crisis. Maxim Moskalkov caught up with the young artist.
Two young children, a boy and a girl, hold a sign that reads, "Bring our mom back." This painting, called Simply Immigration, is the work of an 18-year-old Dominic Kokoza and has already made its way to the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. In 2019, Kokoza won in the annual art competition organized by the U.S. Congress.
I concentrated on the United States immigration crisis, and that was something that I felt deserved an empathetic and legal solution. So when I saw kids that, you know, looked like me when I was younger, you know, behind cages and in bars and stuff, it was really jaw-dropping that that was even an issue that even had to be discussed. I couldn't believe that that was a thing that was happening.
Kokoza says his work was inspired by the family separation policy executed at the U.S.-Mexican border. His works did not go unnoticed. A Virginia congressman, Don Bayer, noticed the paintings. And suddenly, the basement of Kakuza's parents' home, where the young man worked, was filled with journalists.
It's supposed to be a representation of the sadness that these kids were feeling. It was really an emotional painting that I wanted to portray.
Dominic and his sister were born in Guatemala, but were adopted by an American family when they were still infants. Today, the young artists live in Arlington, just a few kilometers away from the U.S. Capitol. But despite all that, he never forgets about where he came from.
It's a model of my family. I live in a primarily white community, so for me that was my personal difference in. And so I have my sister and me, who were adopted from Guatemala as infants, painted a different color than the rest of the rocks. And these rocks are supposed to represent different families in their communities. And then the water represents how communities are always changing and ever the same.
This painting also won in a competition held by the Smithsonian and was exhibited at the Hirshhorn Museum in downtown D.C. For many years now, seasoned artist Gavin Glaikas has been Dominic's mentor.
He's a very impressive young man, and he has that combination of real drive to learn and improve and further his talent level. It'll be fascinating to see where he goes with his work and career. He's obviously interested in those issues.
In the fall of 2020, Dominic Kokoza will start his education at the Rhode Island School of Design, one of the oldest art schools in the country. Maxim Moskalkov for VOA News, Arlington, Virginia.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us on the internet, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram, all under the name VOA Asia. You can also find our full-length 25-minute programs at voanews.com, where you can stream or download them. We thank you so much for joining us today, and we thank our managing editor, Diane Gao. and our VOA Asia team. Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, and Keith Lane. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a super day ahead. Be safe. Be well.